I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Murderous cartels, over-incarceration, the spread of HIV and hepatitis C, many social ills are related to drugs, hence the war on drugs. But critics say strict drug laws have done as much harm to society as the substances themselves. Now, a high-profile international commission has released a report that says the same. The group of 22 medical experts is recommending the decriminalization of drug use and possession around the world. This comes just as the United Nations prepares to convene a special session on drug policy that could shape future laws. Is decriminalization the solution, or are we endangering young people and inviting even higher rates of addiction? That's Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad you've joined us. A controversial topic today, the decriminalization of drugs. Next month, the United Nations will address drug policy in a special session, the highest level meeting of its kind in almost two decades. The last time the UN addressed this question in a special session was 1998, under the theme, A Drug-Free World, We Can Do It. We all know how that went. In 1998, the UN endorsed strict drug policies aimed at stemming all activities related to illicit drugs. Now, a group of 22 medical experts has released a report calling for pretty much the opposite. They want all minor drug offenses, nonviolent offenses, decriminalized. The commission set up by the Lancet Medical Journal and Johns Hopkins University concludes that tough drug laws have done more harm than good. They have fueled violence, spread disease, and this group says they have failed to curb drug use. The report calls for treating drugs much like cigarettes or alcohol, where the intent is to limit harm rather than punish behavior. What would the world look like if drug laws were more lenient? Would it be a narcotics free-for-all? Would more young people become addicted to drugs? Would more addicts seek treatment? What would happen to drug cartels? A lot of questions. And here with us today to give us the commission's take on them is Dr. Chris Byrer. He's a member of the commission and director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Public Health and Human Rights, among his many titles. Dr. Byrer, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. It's great to be here.
So I imagine some of our listeners hear your call to decriminalize, quote, minor nonviolent drug offenses like use, possession, and petty sale, close quote. And they say, wishful thinking. What do you say?
Well, I think what we've seen is in these two decades, as you said, from the initiation really of this approach to a drug-free world, that policy has not worked, manifestly has not worked. And decriminalization in most places with cannabis, but in some other places, Portugal is perhaps the best example.
Yeah, I want to ask you about Portugal.
Went further and decriminalized possession of all drugs. And so we now have some data. Of course, we have four U.S. states that have decriminalized.
Marijuana.
Cannabis.
Cannabis,
indeed.
Yeah.
Yes. And so, you know, we're beginning to have some data, and that's part of what the commission really wanted to do. We wanted to look at the health impacts of the war on drugs quite broadly, looking at all of the health impacts that were out there and that could had enough data to be investigated. And both looking at, of course, the negative consequences of these policies and looking at positive examples. And I'll just, since you raised Portugal, we'll talk about that briefly. Portugal's gone further than almost any other country in Europe. They now have more than a decade of experience with decriminalization for possession. And the first question people want to know, of course, is, did it increase substance use? And the answer is not very much, not measurably, and over time, actually a modest decrease in substance use.
So let me stop you right there. Why do you think that is? I mean, I understand your report was not to bore just into Portugal, but since it is a big part of the evidence
yes.
you cite, the Lancet, you and your colleagues cite, why? It's counterintuitive
it
that
is.
If you lighten penalties and let a substance become more widespread, that use of it would go down?
So I think the first thing that's very important to keep in mind is that there isn't much evidence that the penalties, including the harsher penalties, have had much of any impact on demand or supply. I think that's one of the things.
That's kind of a stunning statement. You chuckled a bit as you said it.
Well,
yes. Something like half of or more than that of everybody in prisons in the U.S. is there because of a drug offense. And you're saying incarceration penalties have no impact on use of drugs?
Well, I think if you look at where we are after this period of aggressive incarceration, and the U.S., of course, unfortunately, incarcerates a higher proportion of our young people than any other country, and much of that is related to narcotics offenses. And here we are in the middle of an epidemic of overdose, of substance use, very high rates of use. So the punitive approach has not worked as a drug control strategy. That's the first thing to say. The war on drugs has failed as a drug control strategy. Going back to Portugal, and you asked the question, why would decriminalization appear to not increase substance use rates? It's very important that they took resources out of the criminal justice punitive approach and aggressively put those toward drug treatment, particularly for folks who have drug dependency. Now, of course, the majority of people who use substances do not have drug dependency, and that's a very important finding of the report as well. But that subset of people who do have a drug dependency problem, what's commonly called addiction, who become addicted, need treatment. And there is treatment out there. It doesn't work for everybody, but it certainly can have an enormous impact on the majority of people who have drug dependency. And so Portugal put resources into drug treatment, and that helped reduce particularly drug dependency.
Yeah, I read that they said that someone found possessing drugs goes before a dissuasion panel.
That's right.
I'm sure that's a translation. I'm not sure it's the only translation, but tell us about that process.
Right. Well, it's an assessment. First of all, it involves social work, usually a clinical person or an educator. The questions are really to understand if a person has a dependency issue and needs treatment, or if, in fact, they're using more what Colorado has now legalized, for example, which is recreational use of cannabis. Those two things are not the same. And that's an important distinction that we all understand immediately when we talk, for example, about alcohol consumption. There is the majority of people who consume alcohol are not alcoholics. They do not have an alcohol dependency, but some people do. And unfortunately, some people get into alcohol dependency very young. The regulatory frameworks for alcohol and tobacco concentrate a great deal on keeping these substances out of the hands of minors. That's the way the regulatory frameworks for decriminalization of other drugs, almost certainly everywhere, are going to look like.
And do you know, is that what they do in Portugal?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and that, of course, is also the case in the four U.S. states that have decriminalized cannabis. This is the case in the Netherlands. It's also the case in the Czech Republic, the other places where we've seen decriminalization. So that's a very important component of this. We're talking about consenting adults. And, of course, we're also talking about regulatory frameworks, for example, that do the same things with using these substances and driving or operating a heavy vehicle or workplace use. None of these things are part of the decriminalization frameworks that are out there. What we're talking about is an approach that looks at these substances, recognizes that they can be harmful, and tries to minimize the harm.
That is Dr. Chris Breyer here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kest. He's a member of a Johns Hopkins Lancet commission calling for global drug decriminalization. He's also president of the International AIDS Society. Do you think the United States should change its drug laws? Join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You mentioned alcohol. Is that really the parallel that you want people thinking of? I mean, a lot of people have big problems with alcohol. It causes a lot of damage in a lot of lives.
Yes, there's no question. But it's also the case that prohibition, which the U.S. experimented with some generations ago, absolute prohibition of alcohol sales and consumption, was a zero-tolerance policy, similar to some of the zero-tolerance policies that are out now around other substances. And again, it failed to work. No one, I think, wants to minimize the harms of some of these substances, including the harms of alcohol. That's not the issue. The issue is, is, for example, mass incarceration and giving people felony convictions for possession a reasonable social approach, given, for example, the relatively modest harms associated with cannabis. The Institute of Medicine, the National Academy of Medicine, looked at this issue of increasing incarceration rates in the United States, and particularly related to substance use, in a very important 2014 report, which we also cited. And they identified that the largest increase was for charges of possession of cannabis. So should the United States continue to incarcerate young people for using a substance that now is decriminalized in a number of other states? Have we benefited at all from giving people felony convictions for substance use and having this, unfortunately, very discriminatory approach toward these sentences? I think the answer is a resounding no on just about every level that we looked at. The evidence suggests that these policies have not worked, and they have increased the harms of these substances, not decreased them. So that's why the evidence suggests that it is indeed time for a rethink.
How do you keep... I'm certainly not arguing for the incarceration policies that we've seen in the United States, but how does a society keep up a social stigma against use of any substance if it is decriminalized?
Well,
is that not part of how we send a message to people that you shouldn't partake of this?
Well, I think first of all, the attitude toward substances, we know, very strongly comes from families, it comes from educational systems. I think the idea that possession ought to be inherently criminalized in a criminal activity is a stigma that has, the evidence suggests, again, when we reviewed it, caused enormous harm. And when we look at how that has been applied, particularly in this country, but it's true in many others, but it's particularly true in the United States, it turns out that it is an extremely racially and gender-based form of discrimination. So what do we mean by that? What we mean by that is that when you look at substance use rates by race and ethnicity in the United States, they don't differ very much between, for example, African-American, Latino, and white American.
And tell me, I have heard this argument before. I'm very interested in it. How do we know that? How do we find out without getting all balled up and who gets charged? How do you look at use?
So there are many surveys of use. There are many databases of this. There are national level health and behavior surveys. The data from an array of sources look pretty consistent. There are some modest racial and ethnic differences in types of substance use. So, for example, Caucasian Americans are more likely to report use of powdered cocaine, African Americans of crack cocaine. But what is strikingly different is not substance use rates and not indeed dependency rates, but incarceration rates, sentencing and incarceration. And that is where you see that while the number or the proportion of teenagers, for example, using cannabis doesn't differ very much by race, the kids who are getting criminal sentences and going to prison and having their lives really disrupted by this are so much more likely to be African American or Latino. We've also seen, unfortunately, that while women remain a minority of the jail and prison population, they are among the fastest growing proportion of people being sentenced for drug crimes, and again, disproportionately African American and Latino. And we actually looked at that and looked at some of the mechanisms for that. Why would that be? And again, it appears to be that they often are at the very low end of the business side of distribution, sometimes just driving cars. And very often, they have no information about the big fish. They have no information about the more powerful people in these narcotics distribution networks. So they don't have anything to trade at plea bargaining. And they end up getting very harsh sentences. Now, the impact of that mass incarceration on African Americans and on minority women has had devastating intergenerational impacts. So, you know, I run the Center for Human Rights at Hopkins. If you are going to impose penalties like breaking up families, incarcerating women, taking people's children away, you have to have an extraordinarily strong justification for that kind of human rights situation. And possession of cannabis doesn't meet that standard. We have had a hugely incommensurate response.
We have to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about the idea of decriminalizing drugs and the racial disparities of the current system with Chris Byrer, a member of an international commission calling for the decriminalization of drugs. Most Americans believe marijuana should be legal, but how would you feel about decriminalizing drugs like cocaine or heroin? You can join our conversation calling us at 410-662-8780 or sending us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Today we're talking with AIDS researcher Dr. Chris Byrer. He's a member of an international commission calling for the decriminalization of drugs. And we were talking about racial disparities when we took a break. And certainly, I don't know that there is a more pressing issue in America, but isn't that an argument for addressing bias? Is it necessarily an argument for decriminalization?
Well, I think it's both. I think the bias in sentencing is a very important part of this, but it's also the case that if you look, for example, at the rising incarceration rates and their relation to charges for cannabis possession, they play a very important role in why we have embarked on this mass incarceration approach in the United States. So that's affected all of us. It is disproportionately a burden on minority communities and on minority women, as we said, but it really does affect us all. And I think the data suggests very clearly two things that we really have to keep in mind. One, it hasn't had much of an impact on use. And secondly, so you can't really justify it as an approach to drug control. And secondly, of course, it's had this enormously disruptive effect on individuals, families, communities. So it is a disproportionately high price to pay for a policy that doesn't work to achieve the goal you want.
I think I'm detecting a pattern in that I ask about drugs and you respond about cannabis.
Mm.
The Lancet Commission's proposal would be to decriminalize all drugs in small amounts, in nonviolent situations. So you're talking about cocaine, you're talking about heroin, you're not just talking about marijuana.
That's right. We looked at this more broadly. The reason I think I'm coming back to cannabis is because I think, of course, every country and every jurisdiction is different. All politics are local. There are some countries that already have decriminalized other substances, like Portugal. There are others that are debating this approach. I think most are looking more at cannabis, and that certainly has been where we have some experience in this country and where we have some evidence. I think everyone will have to debate, and countries are going to have to debate how they address a change away from the war on drugs policies if they're going to do it. Let me give you another example, which is, for example, prescription or medical use of opiates for people with drug dependency. The UK, Switzerland, the Netherlands, a number of European countries are comfortable prescribing heroin or other opiates that are illegal and criminalized in many countries for the subset of people for whom, for example, methadone therapy is not enough. And so that is an example of a tightly regulatory controlled approach where it stays within prescription, within medicine. It's medically controlled. Medical providers are making those decisions. But nevertheless, the state is sanctioning prescription heroin. That is an approach that has worked. For example, there's good evidence both for stabilizing very drug-dependent people, and also for reducing transmission of infectious diseases, because people get clean needles and syringes as part of their prescription. So that's the kind of thing that we're talking about when we look beyond cannabis and start to think about what decriminalization of other substances might look like.
You mentioned a minute ago that all politics is local, and so let me pick up on that. The Maryland General Assembly considered a bill this session that would have decriminalized specific amounts of drugs. It would have made it a civil offense to possess 1 gram of heroin, for example. Mike Lewis, sheriff of Wicomico County, testified against the bill. Here's part of what he told the House committee.
I respond to every heroin overdose or cocaine overdose I have in my county. In each of those overdose cases, it's usually one, sometimes two wax packets of heroin, which is about less than one-tenth of 1 gram of what we're proposing to decriminalize here.
Dr. Breyer, how can you know what is a safe amount to decriminalize?
Well, this is obviously a very important question. And again, let me just say that the situation with overdose and overdose deaths obviously is enormously concerning to everybody in public health, but also all of us in our communities. And there's been an enormous loss of life. And this, again, is not to say that drug dependency and addiction is not harmful. Of course it is, and it can have lethal consequences. The issue, again, is, so how do we best address that? With all due respect to the sheriff, locking people up, giving them felony convictions, making them people who essentially can't find legitimate work after felony convictions for substance use has not proven to be a very effective approach. We want, of course, to look at what works to reduce overdose deaths. Overdose is a great example. So, for example, community distribution of naloxone. And now, of course, a number of pharmacies are selling naloxone without a prescription. Naloxone is a drug.
Narcan. Right?
Narcan,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. Is a drug that reverses opioid overdose. It's mm-hmm. an antagonist. It's not psychoactive. It doesn't have much potential for diversion. It's not going to become a street drug because it blocks opioid impact, but it really can save lives. Community distribution of Narcan and making sure that Narcan is really available, not just to people who use, but also to people who are likely to witness an overdose. Family members, parents, grandparents, concerned spouses, really has the potential to save lives. That's the example of a harm reduction approach. Now, where does decriminalization fit into that? Well, you know, one of the things that happens when people are afraid, for example, if there are substances around, if somebody has used, that there's going to be criminal sanction, that it's going to be the police who come and not paramedics, as happens in many, many countries, is that people don't call. People are afraid. And hence, we have unnecessary deaths from overdose. Or people hide. Tragic example, the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman going to a separate place from his apartment, away from his wife, who might have been able to save his life if Narcan was around, and using furtively and hiding what they're doing. And then, unfortunately, nobody around when they overdose. Now, you asked the question about how do we know and how do we protect people. Again, this is a problem, at least to some extent, relates to the fact that we're talking about, by definition, street drugs, which are cut with all kinds of impurities, and now we know also have been increasingly being cut in some places with fentanyl, which is another opiate with a very high likelihood of causing overdose. In the UK, for example, if you are an opioid-dependent addict and you are getting your heroin from a physician from the government pharmacy, there isn't going to be fentanyl in it. We don't have to worry about that part of the concern. Again, regulatory control also can bring regulatory control around these substances. As it is, by keeping it illegal and keeping it in the shadows, you pretty much ensure all kinds of things are going to be mixed in, and that you won't have an ability, and by you I mean, for example, the FDA and physicians, medical providers, won't have the ability to ensure that these things are as safe as they can be.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Dr. Chris Breyer, a member of a commission studying drug policy and health that was sponsored by Johns Hopkins University and the British medical journal The Lancet. The commission is calling for decriminalization of drugs. Addiction is difficult to treat. Many addicts don't get treatment as it is. Would decriminalization set us up for an even bigger problem? Call us, 410-662-8780, to tell us what you think, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We had a caller who was saying they agree with you, I think, that we should decriminalize drugs because there are social penalties, and that we shouldn't be spending tax money on policing. Was that part of what the commission, part of the commission's arrival at its recommendations?
So we did not do an economic analysis of these different approaches, mostly in the interests of space. The full report is already a large scientific document. It's about the size of 10 standard scientific papers. It's a very important question. There have been economic analyses of the cost of interdiction, the cost of the war on drugs, which is much bigger than policing because, of course, it involves the other groups that are involved in interdiction, border control, and in many places also involves the military. And a number of countries have been very involved. U.S., for example, invested heavily in narcotics interdiction in Afghanistan. And spent an enormous amount of money on that, to little avail. I think the critical issue here is to say, what are societies, communities, governments going to choose to do? Nothing is more expensive than incarceration in the long term. And the social costs of incarceration are enormous. Drug treatment is now happily a part of the Affordable Care Act. We would like, obviously, to see it expanded. We'd certainly like to see it expanded where, for example, Medicaid now has not been expanded. So investments in drug treatment are a critical part of this. And as I said earlier on, Sheila, in our conversation, if you look at Portugal, it's very clear that decriminalization had to be tied to increases in investments in drug treatment. And I think that's where we have at least the best evidence for a more evidence-based and humane policy.
I want to play another clip from Mike Lewis, the sheriff of Wicomico County, that pertains to incarceration. This was also at the General Assembly hearing before the bill was tabled, the bill that would have made it a civil offense to possess small amounts of drugs.
It scares me to death because following criminal cases over the years, when these cases were adjudicated, I'd walk outside the courtroom and family members would be waiting for me. And a woman or man would look at me and say, I just want to give you a hug. With your permission, I'd like to give you a hug. I know my son is now going to prison for 12, 15 years. I know that. To them, that gives them a great sense of satisfaction to know that they're now off the street. They won't be killed in the street. They won't die in the streets. They'll be getting a full meal three times a day, and they now know where they are. And they can go visit them, not at a cemetery, but at a correctional facility.
Dr. Breyer, what about that argument that some users are safer in custody than on their own?
Well, first of all, let's say that while, you know, there may be some reason to think that, it certainly is also true that having a felony conviction in this country is a life-altering event that that can have lasting negative consequences for that individual for a very long time. Prison is not, I think, and the evidence suggests pretty clearly, the right place to put people who need in-house drug treatment. And when we look, for example, at what kinds of drug treatment programs are available in prisons, the U.S. does really rather badly. There are a number of countries that do better with substance use treatment in these facilities. It's somewhat analogous to mental health. There are some people who need to be detained to protect themselves and others from self-harm. We use prisons as disproportionately compared to many other Western countries for the mentally ill, and the outcomes are poor. So I think the argument that people are safer and better off in prisons as opposed to in drug treatment is one that, while at some individual levels, you know, may be compelling, emotionally compelling, when you look at what we've done to a generation and the enormous numbers of people incarcerated in this country compared to anywhere else, I think we have, I think the evidence shows we have enormously erred on the side of over-incarceration.
It seems to me that a big part of your argument is where you would differ with Sheriff Lewis and many others who argue against decriminalization, in that you say, and you are a scientist, that use of drugs doesn't lead inevitably to abuse or to addiction. And many people would disagree with that. I mean, we all remember the ads, I guess, from the 80s. Well, those of us who were around then remember the "This is your brain on drugs" kinds of ads going to fry your brain as soon as you use drugs. What scientific argument, what science do you point to reassure people that we could coexist with people using drugs?
Right. We looked at all the available data on substance use and self-reports of substance use, and where we have data on people meeting basically the standard criteria for drug dependency. And the estimate that we came up with is roughly about 11% of people who use substances. Now, that includes cannabis, and the majority of users are cannabis users. But about 11% of people who use substances worldwide meet the criteria for drug dependency. And those folks really can benefit from treatment, particularly when they're ready for it. And what we're calling for, of course, is for drug treatment on demand, when people want it, need it, can get it. But that also means, of course, that the majority, more than 85%, if we want to be generous, don't meet criteria for drug dependence. And that is because, of course, the potential of different substances for dependence varies. Cannabis is one of the lowest ones, and that's the majority of users. Well, you would think, well, so what does that matter? But as I said, the Institute of Medicine has looked at this, and at least in terms of drug-related sentencing, the thing that has really spiked is cannabis possession sentencing.
So you're saying that you say most people, if there is free access or decriminalized access to drugs, people will use it for a while, and then they'll stop using it, and they won't have gotten hooked. And if they haven't gotten caught up somehow in the criminal justice system because of their use, they'll just pass on to the rest of their lives as if this didn't happen.
The data suggests that is the case. That is different As I said, by substances. So there are certainly the opiates have the greatest potential for dependency, and you know the numbers there look quite different. But it isn't, of course, only opiates that people are going to prison for.
We need to take another short break here. When we come back, more about decriminalizing drugs with Chris Byrer, professor of public health and human rights at Johns Hopkins. He is a member of a commission on drug policy and health sponsored by Johns Hopkins and the British medical journal The Lancet. The commission is calling for decriminalization of drugs. What do you think? Is there a moral question here? Would decriminalization send the wrong message to children? Join our conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Dr. Chris Byrer of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Dr. Byrer is a member of an international commission of medical experts calling for the decriminalization of drugs. You can be part of this conversation. Most Americans have used alcohol. Many have smoked pot. Could that one day be the case with drugs like heroin or cocaine? Do you think it should be? Share your thoughts. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. John emailed us and writes, Ithaca, New York has considered legal sites for heroin users modeled on a longstanding program in Vancouver. Among other benefits, users are under the supervision of medical personnel who not only intervene if necessary for overdoses, but also promote treatment and access to care. Are you aware of the Vancouver program?
Yes, absolutely. I visited the Vancouver site actually just last summer. We had one of our International AIDS Society conferences, our scientific conference in Vancouver, and the InSight site actually has been evaluated very carefully for a range of outcomes. By one of the commissioners, Thomas Kerr is one of the commissioners here. He's a Canadian epidemiologist. So the first thing to say, I think, is it's a busy place, and it's on Vancouver's east side, which is sort of the center of the drug scene there. And there's been a long-standing heroin use scene there. And there were, they've had needle and syringe exchange for many years, so they've had pretty good control of HIV infections, but they still were seeing a large number of overdoses. And so InSight, the idea really was that there'd be a place where people could have supervised use of substances, get clean needles and syringes. They use their own drugs.
So they're bringing in drugs that they've acquired someplace.
That's right.
But this is like a no-go zone for enforcement?
That's right. The idea is it's a safe place for people to come and to use. And if they do have an overdose, there are trained people on site, mostly nurses, who can intervene right away and reverse the overdose. And also that people get clean equipment. But the other thing they get is a place where they feel safe to talk about drug treatment options, for example, to talk about other kinds of social issues, homelessness, reintegrating with family. One of the things, it's a bit like needle and syringe exchange, about these kinds of facilities is that they attract, of course, the people who are the most drug dependent, who are the most frequent users, because it's a service they want. And the evidence shows that they are a gateway into treatment. So, you know, needle and syringe exchange was often vilified in the past as condoning drug use, encouraging drug use, that people were going to increase injecting.
And I'm sure some people hear about what you just described in Vancouver and say the same thing.
Yes.
Condoning drug use.
Again, the evidence suggests that it's helped people get into treatment. It's had an enormous impact on reducing overdose events and overdose deaths in Vancouver. So it has definitely saved lives. This was in some ways a pilot. InSight was the first one. The Canadian federal government, a conservative government at the time, the Harper government, vigorously opposed this. It went all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court to keep this place open. But the court decided in favor based on the evidence. And now we understand with the new Trudeau government that there's some consideration of expanding this program.
How did you get involved in this issue?
I really got involved in it through my work in HIV. I'm primarily an HIV epidemiology prevention researcher. What we saw was that there were so many HIV infections that really were due to reuse of unsterile injecting equipment. And it turns out that drug users are just as concerned about their health as anybody else. And if they have access to clean equipment, they will use it. They want it and they will use it. And so I got involved in programs attempting to implement harm reduction. And then in doing some advocacy around the federal ban on needle and syringe exchange in this country.
We just got an email from Sean, who writes in part, "Sunshine is the best disinfectant. We have better control over the sale of gasoline than we do cocaine. If you want to stop the cartels, let them compete in the marketplace with Walmart," writes Sean in Baltimore. Sean raises the cartels. What effect do you expect if your recommendation is followed on any scale? What effect do you predict for the cartels?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind, for example, and let's stick to the example of cannabis, because that probably is the one of these substances that will be domestically produced and already is being domestically grown. And of course, in many places where it has been decriminalized, there's also some allowance for modest amounts of private growth. So people are allowed up to 6 pot plants in a number of settings. What that is likely to mean is that the cartels that are specializing in sale, distribution, and so forth on the criminal side of this are going to see cuts in market share. Obviously, what we would like to see more than anything is for this to come out of a criminal justice, criminal gang dynamic and into one where there are regulatory frameworks and it is much more managed from a public health, social policy perspective. I think that's going to vary enormously by place and by substance. Drug markets already vary enormously on those fronts. But there is at least some potential there. Now, the flip side, and some of the strongest data in the report, is to ask the question, well, what happens, for example, if a country like Mexico embarks on a drug war and decides to go all out against the cartels, and in the case of Mexico, use their military to do that in civilian areas. They basically embarked upon that in 2006, 2007. We present data in the report that shows very clearly, particularly in the provinces and states where they did this, that there was a marked increase in the number of civilian casualties, the number of civilian deaths, in the number of people who were tortured by the military or the police in these conflicts, and actually enough such that there were measurable declines in life expectancy in some of these affected provinces. So the militarization approach, which has happened in a number of places, really has disastrous social and health consequences.
Elizabeth is calling us from Baltimore. Elizabeth, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I read recently that people who live in poverty, and we have big sections of Baltimore where that's obvious, that what I read was that for a lot of people, this is the only thing that they have found that alleviates some of their despair and their sense of hopelessness in being able to break out of poverty. And I was wondering if that issue has been addressed yet.
Elizabeth, I appreciate the call. Essentially, it sounds to me as if Elizabeth is sort of pushing back against your assertion that pretty much all groups of people or all ethnic groups use drugs at about the same level. She's saying if you're very, very poor, you have more of an incentive to escape through drugs.
Well, I think when you look at, for example, substance use and incarceration rates, there's no question that people of lower socioeconomic status are more likely to go to prison for possession. That data is abundantly clear. Of course, there's a high conflation in many U.S. cities and states. Unfortunately, Baltimore, Maryland is one of them where there is a disproportionate level of poverty in ethnic minority, racial minority communities. We know that. So those two things coexist.
Mm-hmm.
But again, when you tease out substance use rates and look at, for example, the map of cannabis use, it is quite widely distributed in the society. But who's getting arrested? Who is not making bail? Who is going to jail? Who is getting sentenced to prison? Is the poor, minorities, and women.
Do you draw a connection between drug prohibition and terrorism?
So we did not explore this, I would say, in detail in the report at all, except to say that it has often been used by governments as part of the argument for the war on drugs, that there is a counterterrorism component to this. That certainly was a part of the policy driver for the U.S. engagement in narcotics control in Afghanistan, as an example.
Nikki is calling us from Delta, Pennsylvania. Nikki, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I would have to say that I agree with your guest on just about everything he has said. I have been in addiction work for about 25 years, and some of it going back into the 80s. And we were still talking about fentanyl then, being cutting heroin,
mm-hmm.
and people dying with needles still stuck in their arms. It's pretty safe to say we haven't made much progress. I would have to say that for drug treatment to be successful, it needs to be on demand.
Yeah.
And some of the strongest people I know are people who have dealt with addiction successfully. I think those who are living in poverty, who have mental health issues, who have family dynamics that are destructive, who don't have productive work to feel good about, are prone to getting involved. And we can address all of those things.
Nikki, I appreciate the call. While you respond to Nikki, let me ask you one other question to address at the same time, because we have just a minute or so left. What are you hoping for from the United Nations meeting next month?
Well, as we said at the beginning, the UN position currently remains a drug-free world. We can do it. The evidence is, of course, unfortunately, that we could not do it. We've tried that for 40 years, actually, now, but certainly for a generation with this theme. What we're hoping is that the member states and the UN General Assembly itself will take the scientific evidence, the public health evidence, seriously, that the voice of science and the voice of data will enter into this debate. We need to evaluate these prohibitionist policies as though they were any other policy and say, what are the real outcomes? What measurably can we say has been achieved, what not been achieved? And we've looked at the data, and we've analyzed it and put it together, and I think the data are quite compelling that the UN General Assembly and the member states need a rethink on this issue. Now, the caller, Vicky, and thank you for your call, and thank you for your work, spoke very movingly about, how strong people are who have dealt with addiction and come out the other side of it. Those are people we need to engage as well. They are our champions.
I appreciate you sharing the hour with us. Dr. Chris Byrer is a member of the Johns Hopkins Lancet Commission on Drug Policy and Health. He's also director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Public Health and Human Rights, and he's president of the International AIDS Society. I also want to thank the DIS for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The DIS is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington and features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo crab cakes. The DIS is open for lunch and dinner, breakfast on weekends, on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. Join us tomorrow. We'll meet leaders of two nonprofits ravaged by fires in the last 2 weeks and find out what they plan to do next. That's tomorrow on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Right now, it's Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall.
Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.